It is Sunday, September 7th. I am not Scott Roussel. My name is Zach Barnett. And the most difficult job in football is being a backup quarterback because you have to prepare like you're the starter every week, but you never know when your number is going to be called. The most difficult job in football podcasting is being the backup host on the Football Scoop podcast because you have to prepare like you're a starter, but you never know when your number is going to be called. Today, my number was called. It's just the two of us. John Bryce, how are you?
I'm good, and you're the starting quarterback in my book, Zach.
Well, I'm QB2 on my own depth chart for this show.
That's really your humility.
It was a week two with only one ranked matchup, but all of us diehards knew that it was going to give us lots to talk about, and it's week two certainly delivered. Let's start in Gainesville, where a Florida team with playoff aspirations now might be the fourth best team in its own state after a stunning, stunning loss to South Florida.
Yeah, just a brutal loss, and for a number of reasons. Florida never looked crisp in that contest. They didn't get good play really anywhere. Defense played well enough overall to win. You give up 18 points, you're Florida, you're going to expect to win those games. But just a nasty loss and the type of early season setback that Billy Napier and company didn't need because, you can lose early in the season if you have a really manageable or user-friendly schedule, and Florida does not particularly have a manageable or user-friendly schedule whatsoever. So I think for me, the condemnation of the loss is that they're not done losing. And there's no way they're done losing, and that's a really bad thing when we're sitting here on September 7th.
And the most shocking thing about that game to me was the way it ended, and that Florida snatched defeat from the jaws of victory, because South Florida tried a 58-yard field goal with Martin Grammaticus' kid, and it looked good off the leg to me, was dead-on accurate, but just fell a little bit short. And you're like, all right, I think even South Florida knew, like, all right, that was our chance. We got a great kicker, tough shot, but we'll take it. And it came up short. Now Florida just needs one first down to win the game. And on first and 10, it looked like a side adjustment for DJ Lagway. And you trust the quarterback. That looked like an automatic check. Lagway certainly trusts himself. But you got to have the IQ there and be like, hey, even second and 11 on a run play is better than – then second and 10 on an incompletion. So it stops the clock and really throws off that whole drive because now it's second and 10. South Florida still had two timeouts and a two-minute warning. So they had three opportunities to stop the clock. Florida threw again on third down, I believe, was incomplete. And it was just a complete debacle. They killed like 27 seconds, allowed South Florida to get the ball back. And then South Florida on I believe it was a second and 10 swing pass, looked like it was going to be a four-yard loss, breaks two tackles, and then scoots free down the sideline. And that was basically the game. South Florida was able to move the ball and probably could have scored a touchdown if they really wanted to. Florida probably should have let Byron Brown score instead of stopping him at the four-yard line. But they kicked in the chip shot field goal. That whole loss shouldn't have happened, but the last 2.5 minutes was really the worst moment of the game for me for Florida.
And that's what people are going to point to. They're going to point to the fact that details or the lack of attention to detail have turned into lack of wins or way too many losses for Florida under Billy Napier here in year four. And Florida had every chance, as you just outlined, to seal that game and say, well, we won. That's the main thing, but we have a lot to work on. And instead, Florida didn't win. It was pretty even. I think each team had 20 first downs. South Florida outgained Florida by 40 or so yards, but then Florida possessed the ball almost 9 minutes or maybe 9.5 minutes more than South Florida did, Zach. And you just can't lose a game at home when you have that sort of commanding edge in time of possession. What it tells you is that when the Gators have that kind of possession edge and own the ball 9-some minutes more than the opposition but only have 16 points, it lets you know that's not an efficient team. That's not a team that's taking care of its scoring opportunities to put a game away when it has those opportunities. And that's a team that, seemingly willfully allowed South Florida to linger in that game. But let's not also ignore the fact that South Florida is sitting here undefeated. They've got a couple of really huge wins now at this point. You've heard Alex Golish continue to repeat the mantra of Sharif Abdur-Rahim, and this is not the same old South Florida. And he said it again yesterday. I think we're going to be hearing that several more times this year.
So I have a story up on Football Scoop of video captured of the in the press box and the respective coaches going to their elevators after the game. And Florida coaches are dejected. They know what life's going to look like for them the next hour and the next week. And South Florida coaches are absolutely exuberant. And you don't have to be a USF historian to know what beating the University of Florida at Ben Hill Griffin Stadium means for that university. But for this specific team, you now have maybe the best 2-0 record in college football, in that you blew out a respected Boise State team. Now you've won at Florida. Like, all their goals that they started with are still attainable and more realistic than they were when they started. This is a team, I mean, if you can win at Florida and blow out Boise, why can't you win the American Athletic Conference?
Yeah.
Why can't you make the college football playoffs? So they're at Miami next week, and now what looks like one of the biggest games in school history for them. You win that one, you could be an at-large team even if you don't win your conference.
You're exactly right there. Like, if they somehow find a way to start 3-0 with Miami 2-0 and already having a very strong win of its own against then number 6 Notre Dame, then yeah, South Florida suddenly South Florida becomes the chase by every G5 program in America, because if South Florida somehow starts 3-0 and has wins over Boise and then two power conference wins against Florida, ranked at the time, and Miami, we know, is going to be top 10, top 5 at the time, then, again, South Florida becomes the envy of every other team, becomes the envy of a lot of power conference teams, but it becomes the chase suspect of every other G5 team in America, and it stays that way throughout the rest of the year.
So Florida, there was talk Florida with their schedule, 9-3 would be good enough to get them into the playoff, and maybe, but one of those 9 was counted on to be Saturday night against South Florida. So now you might need to go 10-2 against a schedule that in next 2 weeks you're at LSU, at Miami.
Yeah.
Then you're home against Texas after an off week, at Texas A&M, Mississippi State off week. November, this is how they close the season. Georgia in Jacksonville, at Kentucky, at Ole Miss, home against Tennessee, home against Florida State. That's 8 current top 20 opponents in the next 10 games.
Yeah, I call that schedule a widowmaker, because it's there again. There's still a whole lot of L's left on that schedule. Whereas South Florida, again, the trip to Miami coming up, and then you kind of glance down the road at their schedule, and they've got a really tough road game at Memphis late in the year. They've got a battle with Navy, but those are it. Like whatever South Florida does next week, again, if it somehow provides itself with a win, then the road is pretty wide open for like really special things. And as you alluded to, like if South Florida splits with Memphis and Navy and is 11-1, but somehow doesn't win its conference championship, it's still going to have as good a resume as a whole bunch of teams out there. So what Alex Golish is doing here is pretty remarkable. The nature of the beast means that his name is going to continue to populate the rest of this fall about where his next job might be, even though what he's built as South Florida should be the focus.
All right, let's move on. The big noon game was Iowa State against Iowa at Jack Trice Stadium, and the Cyclones beat their in-state rivals at home for the first time in the Matt Campbell era, the first time since 2011. We know your thoughts on Iowa. What do you think about the Hawkeyes?
You know, again, this was I thought this would be a single-score game. I just thought that it might be Iowa winning it 16-13 instead of losing it 16-13. Both teams played great defense. Both teams were pretty tepid on offense, and tepid is probably a generous term, but kudos to Iowa State for doing everything it had to do to get done. This is, as we discussed on Thursday, the battle for the Cy Hawk Trophy, but as a friend of mine who's an Iowa native told me yesterday, the trophy for this game should be a rock, just a giant rock, because every time these two teams meet, especially their offenses, it's just a rock fight. So shout out to my buddy, because he's right. It was a rock fight. It was ugly. It was also beautiful. It was fun to watch. The intensity you felt, like you felt watching that game, or I certainly did watching that game yesterday, that like if somebody uncorked one long touchdown, that might be the difference in the game. And I still feel that way. I mean, Iowa had a slight edge in time of possession. Iowa ended up with a few more first downs, but Iowa State was in control of that game a lot, and it was 13-3. And Iowa did mount under offensive coordinator Tim Lester and quarterback Mark Gronowski, the FCS All-America transfer. They mounted an 85-yard scoring drive, ZB, that was their longest as a program in 4 years. 4 years. That's not 99 yards. That's 85. Like, you have a lot of possessions that originate around your 15. That's the first time in 4 years that Iowa had an 85-yard touchdown possession.
Well, we were both big believers in Mark Gronowski, and why wouldn't we be? We've seen lots of quarterbacks move up from FCS to the Power Four level and excel, including the number one pick in the most recent draft. Mark Gronowski is not going to be the number one pick in the 2026 NFL draft. Through two games, he's 21 of 39 for 127 yards. That's 3.3 yards per attempt, one touchdown, one interception. So 7 yards per attempt is mediocre. Six is bad. He could throw the ball three straight times on average, and Iowa would be facing a fourth and one. I just don't know what to make of it. Joel Klatt was talking about how Iowa State's secondary had no respect for Iowa's deep ball, was sitting on all the underneath stuff, and he was right. I just don't understand Iowa's offense, and I think we've all been saying that for about 15 straight years now.
Yeah, what I think in watching that game, and I heard the same comments from Klatt, and he was right. You kept waiting for Iowa to uncork a double move because you felt like the Cyclone secondary was biting so hard or sitting so hard on the underneath stuff that a double move would have allowed somebody to be wide open over the top. And Gronowski didn't have the world's best protection yesterday, but in watching that game pretty closely, Zach, I'm not sure the arm strength is there. Maybe that's why Gronowski was an FCS All-American, and right now he's just proving to be a slightly serviceable FBS Power Conference quarterback, because I didn't see it. Like, he had a couple of sideline outs that were short, quick, easy throws, quote-unquote easy throws, and they were nearly picked multiple times, and I just don't think the velo is there on his throws right now.
Another school, that Midwestern school that played a big game yesterday with a transfer quarterback, was Oklahoma. And I said on Thursday that I don't know what this win would mean in December, because I don't think anyone predicts Michigan to contend for a Big Ten championship. But in the moment, this game was enormous for Oklahoma. It's not exactly 1 year ago, but it's basically 50 weeks ago, Oklahoma played Tennessee and kind of their coming out party in the SEC. Game day was there. ESPN, it was a big Sunday night or Saturday night ABC game. And Oklahoma was non-competitive against Tennessee. And it was obvious they didn't have an offense. They didn't have a quarterback. So to be basically a year removed from that, it was night and day for the Sooners. They have a quarterback. They have an offense that makes sense, a scheme. So we'll see what this means moving forward for the Sooners. I'm not penciling in to win a national championship, but they have a quarterback, and that was established.
Yeah, they have a quarterback in John Mateer, and Arbuckle is that guy at offensive coordinator right now. So the two go hand in hand. They have a multi-year history together now, but Mateer surprised me. I thought that he would struggle more against the Wolverines defense. I thought the potential complexities that Wink Martindale could throw at him would be a real issue. And instead, he threw for like 270 yards and was very effective on the ground as well, and played almost flawlessly. And then the flip side of that, we talked about a true freshman going on the road into a hostile environment for the first time ever. Bryce Underwood had not shied away from putting a further bullseye on his back, not that his well-publicized $10 million NIL deal didn't already have him bullseyed. But then he also said, the Big Ten ain't never seen a freshman like me. Well, we've seen a lot of freshmen struggle in really raucous environments on the road, and we can now add Bryce Underwood to that list. What we maybe haven't seen is a freshman screaming and yelling in his teammates' faces on the sidelines, and that's what we saw last night. I'll be curious to see the kind of the residual fallout of that moment. ZB, what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I think in general we probably make too much of these sideline blow-ups. I think when the cameras catch them far more often than not, it blows over. It's the heat of the moment type thing. I thought Sherrone Moore called a too conservative game plan. Like, I understand you have a true freshman quarterback. I thought he played to keep it close and played not to lose. And they ran the ball, I thought, especially in the second half, far too often. Like when Bryce Underwood, the rollouts they gave him to intermediate throws, I mean, he looks like an NFL quarterback like right now. I thought they maybe called four or five of those. I might have called 15 or 16 because that was Michigan's best offense right there. And then I thought the key moment of the game was that third and two, Michigan's driving. It's 7-0. They're trying to tie the game late first half. And it just shows that what's fascinating about football is the margins on which these games turn. Michigan called an RPO, and Underwood looked like a stop route or a hitch to Donovan McCulley. And McCulley did not expect the football, was blocking, thought it was going to be a run play, and it looked like it was going to be pass interference on him. Because he gave the DB no chance to make a play on the ball because he's blocking it so hard. So McCulley reads that differently and catches that pass. Maybe Michigan scores and might be 7-7 at halftime. Instead, they missed the field goal. Oklahoma goes down and scores. It's 14-0 at halftime. And with the way Michigan was calling that game, there's no chance they were going to overcome a 14-point deficit in the second half on the road.
Michigan, I love this stat, ZB. Michigan with 13 points and only 12 first downs in the game. So you can't win. You probably can't win against an FCS bye opponent at home with 12 first downs. But 12 first downs on the road in the SEC, that's tough sledding all day long and all the momentum. I know you said people didn't necessarily have Michigan penciled in as a playoff contender or whatever. I would disagree. Like, there was so much hype about Michigan, and somebody just going into the weekend on one of the kickoff shows was touting Michigan as a potential 10-win team, and instead Michigan looks like it's a team set for more growing pains. 9 for 24 for Bryce Underwood. So he distributed the ball decently on those nine. Three different receivers had catches of like at least 20 yards or 19 yards, 25 and 44. So they had some chunk play success. They did not have any sustained success against the Sooners. And again, like, that's a signature victory right now for Oklahoma, along with Alabama late last year, a game that, fully knocked Alabama out of the playoff hunt for all intents and purposes. But this one was as close to must win as it gets for Brent Venables because of what the meat on the rest of the schedule.
Yeah, speaking of that meat, so John Mateer ran the ball 19 times for 74 yards. Oklahoma's got to find a traditional running game with its running backs. Javonte Barnes, 6 carries, 24 yards with a long of 10, and he was the best Oklahoma running back last night. Torrey Blaylock, 9 for 24 with a long of 6. Jay Knott, the Cal transfer, 4 of 9. That's not going to get it done against the SEC. They're going to need to find a traditional running game. But outside of that, Oklahoma's got a really good football team.
Yeah, really. Good.
Let's stay in the state of Oklahoma. Why hasn't Mike Gundy been fired yet?
Holy smokes! Only because of longevity. Because any other coach that poured fuel on the fire the way that he did before the game, and then saw his team extinguished by the opening kickoff, wouldn't have much ground to stand on. And I think we've already said this was really a juncture point season for Mike Gundy and his tenure at Oklahoma State. He's gone from being a guy that a lot of programs pursued to being a guy that looks like the game has passed him by. And I saw Oklahoma State touting going into the weekend that Mike Gundy was the career active wins leader for wins against top 25 opponents with 40. and that's all well and good, but they've now amassed a pretty significant upheaval in that one loss record against ranked opponents in the last couple of years. And of note, like lurking almost just one or two spots behind him on that list, Kirby Smart. Kirby Smart's only been a head coach since 2016. And Mike Gundy's like the third longest tenured coach in FBS. So things are not good in Stillwater. You wouldn't necessarily be surprised that Oklahoma State gave up 69 points to a high-powered team like Oregon in the olden days, and by which I mean 5 to 10 years ago, but you would have thought they might have lost that game 69-42. But instead it was 69-3, and that was the score, you know, through three quarters. And you had an excellent write-up about it, Zach. We all respect Dan Lanning, but he's becoming must-see theater on the weekends.
Yeah. It's funny because Mike Gundy said he meant it as a compliment, but that's not how Oregon took it. So I saw Gunnar Gundy, I believe it was Gunnar, one of Mike's sons, tweeted out a long thread about all of his dad's accomplishments and how there is no Oklahoma State football without Mike Gundy, and then basically ended his thread with shut up and be grateful. Read the room.
Yeah, that always yeah, you're making $7-8 million a year. You be grateful, not the other way around.
Yeah, no one denies Mike Gundy's impact on Oklahoma State football, but telling people to shut up and be grateful when you lost by 66, not the right time. Let's save that for December 1st or thereabouts when Mike Gundy takes a buyout and his season ends, because that's where I think this is heading for Oklahoma State.
Yeah, completely agree. Again, I hate to sound like a broken record here, but again, this was not a early season non-conference loss, and you think, okay, well, bounce back, and you still got conference play. There's nothing to suggest that Oklahoma State's going to even be very competitive in the Big 12, which is at best the third best power conference out there, probably the fourth best.
Possible Mike Gundy replacement. I don't know. Let's roll with it. Mississippi State, Jeff Lebby scored a big win over Arizona State. Got up 17-0, nearly lost it, and then snatched the win back, and easily the biggest win of Jeff Lebby's career in Starkville.
I'm super impressed. And I've talked maybe even last week on our pod that I really like Jeff Lebby as a coach and as a person, but acknowledged like how severely far behind Mississippi State has been left in the NIL era. And so for them to win that against one of the hottest, most in vogue teams in college football since the start of the 24 season is really significant, because I talked to people like in that, I talked to coaches in that footprint of SEC country who weren't sure that Mississippi State could win a league game this year. And now all of a sudden they have one of the SEC's best non-conference wins. And it wasn't a fluke until they let Arizona State come all the way back to take a 20-17 lead. But then when you have the resolve to go win the game and win it in the manner in which Mississippi State did, and to have that kind of composure and that sort of win at home, gives you reason for optimism there. Like, they looked well coached in that contest, which I think is very striking. And they're still so far behind their SEC colleagues in what they have for NIL and rev share. And it's, you know, that's playing on unequal footing right now, but you can still coach them up and win some of those games like that. And that's as good a win as Mississippi State could have possibly hoped for going into, you know, 2 weeks into year two under Jeff Lebby.
And Arizona State, meanwhile, seems a bit like a dead team walking, and they seem that way since fall camp when Kenny Dillingham said, hey, someone has to go 3-9, why not us? It seemed like the character of this Arizona State team does not hate to lose. They accepted a loss last night. It seems like he's wanted to dunk his whole team's head into a bucket of cold water all season long. And maybe this loss will be that cold water. If not, then Arizona State, Big 12 is not a conference that you want to play in to play down to your competition if you're Arizona State.
No, you're exactly right. The flip side of that is the Big 12 is still a very attainable conference. And so I think that the Sun Devils do have time to get things righted or to just play with greater passion and urgency. And I think passion might be the number one characteristic that I would use to describe Kenny Dillingham. It would be passion or it would be energy. And his team didn't really possess a lot of either of those.
Speaking of passion and energy, Missouri and Kansas, the border war was back after a 14-year hiatus, back and forth game. Missouri got it done. I've criticized Eli Drinkwitz for racking up a lot of empty calorie wins. This was steak and potatoes type win. Full on congratulations to Missouri. That's a big, big game, especially at home when you can't lose and they went out and got it done.
Zach, that was talk about two completely different performances. Missouri jumped out to a 6-0 lead and then botched the PAT, and Kansas almost returned it for 2 points. He probably got to the plus 40 before being shoved out of bounds after dealing with that. And then very quickly, Kansas reeled off 21 consecutive points, including a defensive score. So they silenced the Faurot Field crowd. They have all the momentum. It's 21-6. And then this is one of the most staggering stats we might see all season long. It'll probably make it to your magical box score story. And that is the second quarter alone, Missouri snapped the ball 36 times on offense. Kansas had just 4 offensive plays. Missouri had like 201 yards of offense just in the second quarter, Zach. It was nuts. And they used that second quarter to come all the way back and tie the game at 21, and you just felt everything change. Like Kansas not only didn't have a rhythm in the second quarter, it just never had the ball. I think Missouri had time of possession of literally like 14 minutes and 4 seconds or something in the second quarter. It was absolutely insane. Those other stats are absolutely on the money. 36 plays, because somebody pointed out to me that Missouri had 36 offensive plays in the second quarter. And I laughed and I said, Notre Dame only had 58 total offensive plays Sunday night against Miami.
Bo Prabula, obviously Missouri spent to get him from Penn State. He left Penn State in the middle of their playoff run to go beat Missouri starting quarterback. And then I had an agent reach out to me with kind of like some flashing warning signs when that job went deep into camp and he wasn't named their starter. Bo Prabula played flawless football yesterday. 30 of 39, 334 yards, 3 touchdowns, no picks. Hats off to him.
Yeah, he had the one turnover on a scramble that ended up becoming that Kansas defensive touchdown, but he was making a play and just had the ball punched out. But yeah, he was much more efficient in the throw game than maybe I'd expected to see from him, especially against, you know, an overall very quality opponent. Kansas got some real defensive issues, Zach, tackling. They're a very poor tackling team right now. They also are kind of feast or famine on the defensive line. They're either standing it up in there and forcing a stalemate or getting some penetration, or they're getting absolutely gashed and blown off the ball. There's not a lot of just in between steady play from the KU defensive front right now.
All right, let's go rapid fire here. What was your take on Ole Miss, Kentucky?
I think Ole Miss has got some issues. I talked to a friend of mine in Lexington, very closely associated with that program, and I told him Friday night, I said, I don't know what it is, but I think Ole Miss is in trouble. And he said, certainly there seems a belief around here that Kentucky can win this game. That ended up not being the case. But I just think that we talked a lot about Jackson Dart last year on this podcast. Maybe we didn't quite appreciate enough what he meant to Lane Kiffin. So I just think Ole Miss has really significant issues. They lost a ton off of last year's 10-win team, but it was only a 10-win team after the bowl game. Had it been a 10-win team in the regular season, then it would have been a playoff team, but it lost a couple of games it shouldn't have lost, notably last year at home to Kentucky and then late season on the road to Florida, a game which cratered Ole Miss's playoff hopes. But I just think Ole Miss has real issues right now. Not a lot of rhythm on offense, not a lot of consistency on offense, and too many mistakes, too many giveaways.
You mentioned this one on Thursday because the coaches that you visited with back in April had it circled way back then, and they went out and got it done. Ohio 17, West Virginia 10.
Yeah, shout out Bobcats. That's a big one. I almost went to that game. The fine people of Bobcats football had invited me back on this weekend, and I just couldn't execute the logistics to make it happen. I should have been there, obviously, in hindsight, because that would have been a magical opportunity for us here at Football Scoop to chronicle that win firsthand. But, you know, Ohio looked really good last week in opening on the road at Rutgers and played the Scarlet Knights really tough for a long time. And I'm just really happy for that staff. Like, they got a bunch of good dudes that are just ball coaches on there. And you start with Smitty, the head coach, and what a fabulous, fabulous win for them. You know, Ohio is a program that's done a lot with less, but it was always under Tim Albin. And now it's Brian Smith, and what a momentous victory for them. And those two teams, they're separated by a lot in the world of athletics, because Ohio is G5 and under-resourced, and West Virginia is a power conference team with nice resources, not the most elite resources, but they're not separated by much geographically, and that's just a huge, huge win for the Bobcats.
Two teams in the running for most miserable start to this season. We'll start with Virginia Tech losing to Vanderbilt.
Yeah, and we said, Scott and I wrote it in our ACC Intel piece this past week, midweek, Wednesday. Listeners, please go on the site and find that and check it out, because I felt like we had some really solid info in there, sort of assessing and sharing what the landscape is of the ACC for every coach. And we said then there might not be a hotter seat anywhere in the ACC than in Blacksburg, Virginia. And that's absolutely the case today. So another grueling loss. That's an 0-2 start. That's losses to two SEC teams. And we know Virginia Tech and the school leadership went on the record in August and said, we're committed to football. We need to raise $200 million. Well, the number that – and we wrote about it. We wrote extensively about it on Football Scoop, Zach, as you well know. But then the number that was told to me late this week by an agent was the fact that they need to raise $200 million. And last year they were around $75 million. So, you know, you're talking about a significant shortfall there. Virginia Tech has to decide how serious it is about football, but it's more serious than losing at home to Vanderbilt, even if this is not your dad's Vanderbilt.
And then for my money, the most miserable team in college football right now is Kansas State. They obviously lost in miserable fashion to Iowa State, struggled to beat North Dakota. It's not North Dakota State, but North Dakota, and then lost at home to Army on Saturday.
Yeah, and that's an Army team that just lost to Tarleton, which, again, credit to Scott. He said going into last weekend he had Army on upset alert, but that was an Army team that was dealing with an injury to its quarterback and lost a lot off of last year's team that was so fabulous and started last year 10-0, ends up winning the conference championship. Beat Tulane to win that conference championship, and only had a couple of losses all year long to Notre Dame and to arch rival Navy. And Jeff Monken, man, he's just a ball coach, and he's been at Army now and done phenomenal things there. But a win like that might be one of the ones that causes somebody to come along at the end of this season and pry him away from Army for a power conference job. He's been really close. He was in the mix at West Virginia until I think some money people at West Virginia stepped in and said, no, we want to do the Rich Rod redo. And that Army team, obviously you expect an Army team to be disciplined because that's their way of life, but they're so disciplined on the field. And they just showed as much character and mettle as any team here early in the season in college football to bounce back from a home loss to an FCS program to go win at a Kansas State team, Zach, that I think we all four of us Scott, Doug, you and I would have thought would challenge for the Big 12. And now K-State has a couple of really debilitating losses already.
Yeah, I think some soul searching is due for Chris Klieman and his coaching staff, because it seems like the second straight season, the hole is not as big as the sum of the parts. And I think it starts with Avery Johnson. It seemed like right as a freshman, it seemed like he was a better athlete than quarterback, which you'd expect because he was a freshman backing up Will Howard. He's now in year three at K-State, and year two as a starter, and still seems like a better athlete than quarterback. So not suggesting anyone needs to make a move, but I think Chris Klieman needs to do some soul searching why his team is not playing up to paper. All right, we're over 35 minutes into this. Let's hit the 18th hole here, JB. Give me one team that we haven't mentioned that you want to shout out.
You know, I was really impressed with Troy going on the road to Clemson yesterday and dealing with a really lengthy weather delay and ultimately taking a 16-0 lead on the Tigers in Death Valley. Clemson rallied and won that game 27-16, but a really encouraging performance as Jared Parker is in year two on down there in the southern parts of Alabama with the Troy Trojans. So that's one of the ones that probably stood out to me the most. Another one really big time was BYU. They're 2-0 now. They've got Bear Bachmeyer, the true freshman, at quarterback, but they're doing it with defense. They won, and Stanford's a bad team. Stanford's just a really forgotten program right now. They won 27-3. So they've had a shutout last week, and they've given up 3 points this week. BYU doing it with defense and a real physical tenacity that matches the personality of their head coach, Kalani Sitake.
For me, I will shout out for what, first. I'll stick to one, and I will. I'll, if the shoe fits, wear. I'm gonna shout out North Texas. They went on the road and beat Western Michigan. Excuse me, in double overtime. It's the first time North Texas has played any team from the state of Michigan. Found themselves down multiple scores early, fought back, won the game. I don't know the last time that program has gone more than 1,000 miles from home in one football game. But I bet you it's been a long, long time. So shout out to Eric Morris and his crew for getting that done.
Good. That's a good one, ZB. Good on you shouting that one out. And I'm just pulling from your playbook by naming more than one team here. But I do want to close it by mentioning Illinois, not just going on the road to a very quality Duke team and handling business, but Duke had rallied back and made that, you know, a super tight contest. And then Illinois just won it going away 45-19. They possessed the ball 12 and a half minutes longer than Duke. That's really imposing your will on the opposition, especially on the road to do that. And the question I wanted to ask, I was thinking about this last night, so I thought we would have more of us on the pod, but I'll still ask it to you because I value your opinion. Do you think this might be not just Brett Bielema's best Illinois team? Could this be approaching having the potential of being Brett Bielema's best team anywhere of his head coaching stops?
It's a good question. Off the top of my head, I think he took over Wisconsin from Barry Alvarez in 2006, and I think that team went 11-1 and would have been a dangerous team if they had a 12-team playoff back then. So I think that's a pretty high bar to clear. So I'm going to say no, but I certainly without question is best post Wisconsin team. That's not even close.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think he had a couple of Rose Bowl teams at Wisconsin, but I think this one is on a path that it will enter the conversation.
I'm going to break my own rule and mention Texas State going to the Alamo Dome and beating UTSA. Jeff Traylor was 29-3 at home. So tough place for anyone to win. And that's a rivalry game win that Texas State's now beaten their biggest rival two straight times. So shout out to GJ Kinney and company. All right, we're nearly 40 minutes in. The job of a backup quarterback, John Bryce, is not necessarily to fit the ball in tight windows 25 yards down the field. It's to get the team in the right play and move the ball down the field, even if it takes 20 plays. So that's what I think we've done here. Do you agree?
I absolutely agree. I think that kudos to you. I think there's a quarterback competition on hand now because Scott's going to have a hard time wresting back hosting duties from you because you've been a sublime performance and you've possessed the ball well. That's why we've ended up with a 40-minute podcast.
There we go. All right. Football Scoop Podcast. We'll be back hopefully with the full crew on Tuesday, but thank you for listening.